Now I'd like to introduce our speakers. Dale Dirkholtz is the principal of Grain Cycles, an independent commodity consulting analytical firm in Illinois. He retired from AgriVisor, a firm jointly owned by Growmark and Illinois Farm Bureau. Growmark is a large Midwestern farm supply and grain cooperative, while Illinois Farm Bureau is a producer association. He was the senior market analyst at his retirement. Prior to that, he headed the research departments for two Chicago brokerage houses. He began his career as an analyst for a producer market consulting firm that had clientele across the United States. Along with researching aspects of the agricultural markets and economies, he developed marketing strategies for producers and helped develop new products for producers to use in marketing as well. Over his career, he primarily analyzed grain and livestock markets, working with producers and merchants of those commodities. During his stint in Chicago in the early 1980s, Dale also did research on various financial and forex markets. His style includes both the fundamental and technical perspectives. He has spoken on markets and the agricultural economy at meetings ranging from local events to large international gatherings. Radio, newspaper, and TV reporters have regularly used him as a source of expertise for their reports. Dale has a BS in agriculture and an MBA from the University of Illinois. Our next speaker, Clayton Pope. Clayton has an extensive background in the world of agricultural risk management. From managing the largest flour operation in the industry of both the CME and the Chicago Board of Trade, working as a consultant serving many of the country's largest grain elevators, years of flour trading and order filling at the Chicago Board of Trade, and acting as co-risk manager in charge of corn for Cargill's Premier Farm Consulting Group, he's gained invaluable experience. This experience allows him in his current role as owner of Clayton Pope Commodities, LLC, to effectively assist today's farming operations with their risk management needs. Clayton Pope Commodities, LLC, is a registered introducing broker and advisory firm with 8 locations across the country. Let us welcome Dale and Clayton. First, let's start off with Dale. Welcome to the 2020 NAFB convention, a virtual convention. Dale, thank you for presenting today, and could you share some of your opening thoughts, please?
Good talking with you, Rusty. Yeah, you know, we'll come in here today, and we're gonna. That didn't work very well, but that's okay. We're gonna show people some things from 30,000 foot level, some things in commodities. What I got here on the front that I think people really need to know and understand is looking at a broad commodity index. In this case, the continuous commodity index. This chart's a weekly chart. And we start back in here with the high we had back in 2011, 2012. And it looks like, you know, the whole move down into the low we had here with the coronavirus panic back in April, May, probably came to a conclusion back there. And then we've had a nice lift out of this. This really kind of dovetails well when you go back and look at this monthly chart of this, and you again see the low we put in back here in April, May, timed in perfectly for a 3-year low, and suggest, you know, we're going to see some kind of a broad shift in terms of commodity prices in general that probably is going to stay with us over the next, 2-3 years, something like that. There's a bigger low out there, a couple of 3 years out, so maybe 2026 that is going to be out here a 9-year low, and also for this index looks like it's going to be a 27-year low. So I think the strength we're going to see out of commodity prices here over the next 2 to maybe 4 years probably is going to be that, something short term. Probably going to dovetail into the dollar. The dollar's got a 3-year cycle to it as well, with lows coming about every 3 years. This one here in 2017 might actually occur in early 2018, but here we were in 2020 again, timed in perfectly to put a low. So we might see a little bit of strength. It's going to be interesting post-election to see how this turns out. But ultimately, I think the decline we had in the dollar here off the peaks we had back here in 2016, again, going up there early in 2020 and breaking down, is kind of setting the stage. We're getting ready to go into a generally weaker dollar. And that, again, fits well with commodity prices being strong, too. The corn market itself, the low we put in April was a 5.5-year low. I can't impress that enough on people. That really completed, you know, what looked like a long-term cyclic low. The low we had in August was a 2-year low. And again, with that 2-year low coming in place, really set the stage for strength. Didn't anticipate this much this soon. But also with this in here, you look at shorter term cycles. We had a 40-week low in April. We had a 20-week low here in the end of September. And we got another low out in here somewhere due in probably February, maybe early March at the latest. So I'm kind of wondering maybe if we're not getting to some kind of an exhaustion phase, at least for now, with the market waiting on some fresh news. And we always have to remember, the market always needs new ammunition. And with everything we've put in this, you really question, what more is there to come today? And Clayton will talk a little bit about the fundamentals. Beans also, the low back we had in April here was a 3-year low. We came back with a 2-year low in August. We had a 32-week low come in place with August. And so we have another one out in here in April, it looks like, with the next 32-week low. And you know, with everything that happened here, with the early talk about problems in Brazil and to a lesser degree in Argentina, you again, when you look at beans and with all the export sales we've already put on the books, you know, you really kind of go, is there really a lot left in this market to give us a big push to the upside other than some minor strength? And we had a big high in soybeans back in 2016 at $12. So I think we're going to have some difficulty if we try to move on higher to get over that $12 level here until we get some more influence, some more news that would suggest, you know, this thing could get even tighter yet. Wheat, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of things in the mix here at this point in terms of cyclic influences. 9- and 6-year lows have been behind us. We don't have a good short-term wheat seasonal, and basically with wheat, we rely on seasonals more than anything else in the short-term bottom back here in July. With the action we've had in wheat prices here over the last 3 to 4 weeks now, you kind of wonder if we haven't already seen some kind of a winter peak. So it's a matter of, you know, we're really looking for some new influences to come into this game, maybe to give us some more strength to the upside at this point. So when I look at the mix of grains, I'm not necessarily bearish, but I see a marker right now that I kind of think might be running out of bullets, at least for the short term.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dale. Clayton, as Dale mentioned, a bull market needs to be fed every day. Can you run down some of the fundamentals that we're looking at as we visit on this Monday?
Yeah, you bet, Rusty. For one thing, it's a pleasure being on here. I apologize, I'm working out of a truck right now. I'm visiting branch office down in the Memphis area in Arkansas. We're visiting some customers. It's great to see them in person. But yeah, we've thrown an awful lot of bullish factors at this market, no doubt about that. And you do kind of wonder if we could be running out of fuel in the short term. But on the other hand, there's still some very live issues out there that could definitely be providing some more fuel. But for one thing, I mean, the bearish sentiment when we started this thing off in August was kind of off the charts in terms of what a dismal outlook could look like. I mean, people were talking about a 3.3 billion bushel corn carryover and beans of, you know, whatever, 500 or 600, something like that, million. And then all of a sudden things started to turn. But it's been an interesting rally just because the funds came in here with both feet and have just propelled this thing nonstop. And it is very unusual, not unprecedented, but it is pretty extraordinary to see a move be as one-sided as this one has been. And as such, it's really caught a lot of shorts off guard, I think. Funds, I think, are largely responsible for that. I think it's interesting. Everybody keeps referring to this whole thing as a demand-led market. We've got the first demand-led market in a long time. It's interesting to note, though, that if you look at the carryover, and actually the whole balance sheet for soybeans, since the August supply and demand compared to the November one, really the only significant change in the demand side was exports, which have gone up by 75 million bushels. Now, 75 million bushels is a lot of bushels, but it's not that many. On the other hand, the supply in that same period from August to November, the supply in soybeans has dropped 346 million bushels. So the net of those two is about the 420 million bushel drop in the carryover. So it's definitely been a pretty hair-raising drop to see that carryover go from 610 to 190. A drop of 420 doesn't happen very often. But it's interesting to note that to some extent, calling this a demand market is a little bit of a misnomer, it seems like to me. The absolute thing that changed the most is supply, without question. But looking forward, demand obviously is on everybody's mind because China is the unanswerable question for now. We'll just have to wait and see. Certainly the timing of things would suggest that they are on the tail end of their buying program right now. I would think going forward, the biggest question remains supply. And that, again, looks down to South America, like Dale touched on. You know, Brazil, Argentina, they've had their problems looking at some planting delays, but let's face it, it's still a little early. As a matter of fact, last week, I think two of the main Brazilian consulting firms down there both raised their production estimate for Brazilian soybeans. I believe somebody over the weekend lowered theirs, but the point is it's not this universal call for some crop disaster in Brazil when an awful lot of the think tanks down there actually think things are looking pretty darn good. So we'll have to see. The devil will be in the details going forward. No question, moisture levels are very dry overall. This is delayed planting for both Brazil and Argentina. But look how many years we've started off dry. I know it's a different type of soil, everything down there. But the real test of this market fundamentally, I think, is quite a bit down the road, a month or two down the road probably. See just how long this dryness lasts.
Okay. Would you be comfortable with me opening up to some questions, gentlemen?
Sure.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Clayton, I would like to ask you first off, when we talk about South American weather and we talk about the dryness and also perhaps the delayed start to the rainy season there, with delayed planting in South America, how does that factor into perhaps when it comes to South America being able to market those soybeans to China? Will that keep the U.S. in the market longer, perhaps, as we've seen in the past? How do you think that plays out?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a factor and one that is largely discounted in the market. No question. I mean, if you look at their planting date percentages and compare it to average, it would suggest that, hey, they've caught up really quick, not that big of a deal. But averages can be deceiving. Obviously, an awful lot of acres did get planted later than they should have. And it's those early planted acres that gives Brazil an earlier, well, they can give it an early entry into the world export market. And that has been pushed back, no doubt about that. So that's definitely a valid point. It does extend the U.S. growing season, I think. How much that will matter will really kind of depends on how much China wants to take that ball and runs with it. And I think that will be absolutely dependent on what Brazil's crop looks like. In other words, you know, we might have a good chance to extend our selling season and maybe have some real significant add-ons to our sales. However, if China senses that there's not a big problem brewing in Brazil, it would be, in my opinion, and a lot of people's, I think, that China would probably prefer to buy from Brazil than from us and might drag their feet. And a longer selling season might not necessarily transport into, you know, a significant boost to our sales, because if they think they can get it cheaper and later from Brazil, they probably do have most of their near-term needs met.
Okay. I'm going to jump around quite a bit here, but I had another question for Dale. Going back, Dale, to the dollar, and you mentioned a three-year cycle for the dollar, and we're just coming off an election. And, of course, when it comes to the dollar index and how our exports are valued compared to other countries, how do you think post-election, how do you think the dollar index may play into perhaps our ability to export around the world?
Well, given the fundamental structure we're dealing with this year, to where we really are the only place in town at least at the moment, for people to go and secure supplies, whether you're talking about beans or corn, to a lesser degree, even wheat, because we've seen strong prices of wheat in Russia and some withholding there, and there's some talk about the long haul anyway, we could see some export suspension. So the dollar moving up a little bit might tend to inhibit selling activity just a little bit, new sales per se. But we've also got to factor in the thought in here, soybeans in particular. We are so far ahead of normal as far as export sales are concerned. You know, I have not seen unshipped export sales this large in history. And I mean in history. So we've already got a lot on the books. We've got a lot of new crop corn sales on the books as well, which a lot of people don't understand. So, you know, if the dollar starts to rise after we go through this election, and I've seen some economists and some of the big financial houses out of the East Coast actually voice both opinions, bullish and bearish both. But I suspect now some of the thoughts here with the election being behind us, and generally people are sort of comfortable with Biden and his policy, we might see some money flow into the U.S. from some different areas and give the dollar a little bit of strength, a little bit of gain. And so that can actually slow down our new sales a little bit, especially where we're already so far ahead, especially in soybeans. Corn, we've got a reasonably large unshipped book on the game right now. So we may not see in here temporarily new sales continue to trickle in like they have here over the last 2 to 3 months, beans again in particular, and wheat. There are enough other sources, we'll probably see that calm down a little bit. I think the big thing though, when we talk about currencies as far as U.S. ag is concerned, I look at the dollar really as an overall barometer. I don't look at it specifically, because when we look at our competitive export structure, you have to look at what's the Chinese yuan doing, what's the Brazilian real doing, what's the Argentine peso, it's relentlessly down it seems, and what's the Russian ruble doing, because those are really the currencies that really guide, you know, the activity as far as the flow into our grain exports per se, because those are either our biggest buyer a lot of times, or there are main competitors out there. So I just look at the dollar as a broad barometer, and I think that'll have some influence as far as what we see generalistically in commodity demand and commodity prices, but maybe not specifically in the grains.
Okay. I'd like to ask Clayton the next question, and Dale, I would like your thoughts afterwards too. With the phase one trade deal with China, it seems to have put a floor underneath our soybeans, our corn, our cotton, sorghum exports. Again, you know, the boats may not be sailing, but it's definitely positive talk. Over the weekend, recent news, 15 countries signing a trade deal with China, and the U.S. not signing onto that. It's called the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. Going forward, with our new administration, as we talk on this Monday, does that trade deal, Clayton, does that throw any wrinkles? Is that something that should be on our radar? What are your thoughts on that?
That's a extremely important topic, I think, Rusty, and a very significant development. And I don't see it as good news. Anytime you see a huge world trade agreement forged with us excluded, I mean, that's says a lot, I think. As far as phase one, I mean, obviously we have a real complex political situation going on right now, but even though the sales pace in the last few months has been extraordinary, and, you know, look at record levels on the books and so forth, like Dale said, they have fallen very short of their phase one commitments. And so you say it's put a floor under the market, or a little bit of a bid under the market. While that may be true, they haven't lived up to their end of the deal. And they also made it very clear a week or two ago that with the Biden victory, that they wanted very much to renegotiate phase one of the trade deal. So I think it's back to square one, personally. I mean, they didn't live up to what they had agreed to before so far. And that's what was supposed to be shipped by the end of the year. That's not going to happen. So they clearly have not lived up to it. And now you have, number one, them saying they want to renegotiate. And number two, they've got this huge deal. I mean, let's face it. I think it's sort of the elephant in the room. I don't think there's much doubt they would rather buy from other countries, mainly South America, than us. And I think this these latest news items increases that possibility.
Okay. Dale, your thoughts on the subject? Any ideas?
You know, I think Clayton probably summed it up pretty well, but as I've read, you know, what little I've read about this new trade deal we've got over in Southeastern Asia, you know, it's really those countries over there in that part of the world. Japan is also a part of this mix, but we've already got a trade agreement in place with Japan, so I don't see an interruption there. It could create some issues and some difficulties doing business in places like Thailand or Cambodia or Vietnam, someplace like that. We'd have to go back and look at trade policy with those specific countries themselves and what may already be in place. So I don't know that this is a huge negative. It's kind of an unknown, but if it's really just confined to that part of the world, it's not really a huge deal. You know, I think maybe a bigger thing which might solve some of it, if they move us back into the TPP again, which was already put in place, because if we go back into the TPP, that would kind of guarantee, you know, some of the things that we can do with some of these other countries in this whole Pacific Rim area. So there's a lot of unknowns right now because we're seeing a lot of shifts in trade policy. As far as the Chinese deal itself, and the Chinese haven't lived up to phase one. And as Clayton expressed, you know, they've already given the indication that they want to renegotiate that trade deal. You know, I think I really worry about what we're going to see as far as trade, not in the short term, but going deeper into 2021 and maybe on into 2022 and 23, because we never even got beyond 2021 with the trade deal we put in place with China. So we got to worry that there are some drags out there in the long haul. And that's going to be something that the market, I think, is going to have to come to grips with, especially as we get a new administration put in place and we learn more about how they're going to handle policies. But I would have to say, like Clayton did, I'd say it's more of a drag. It's more of a negative than it is a positive looking ahead.
Okay. Dale, thank you for bringing it up. TPP at the NAFB convention, it must have been 8 years ago, prior to the election between President Trump and Hillary Clinton. At the meeting, I believe it, I may be off on my years here, but at the meeting we had the leaders of eight different commodity organizations that were speaking in favor of TPP, whether it be wheat, beef, corn, soybeans. Again, this is an unknown, and I know you don't have a crystal ball, but Dale, if you could just give me, do you have a feel, and Clayton, I'm going to ask you this too, do you have a feel of how things may change on the trade front as we go with the new administration compared to kind of a go-it-alone attitude that we've seen the last 4 years?
Well, I think certainly, Rusty, when you look at the administration that's coming in versus the administration that's going to be walking out the door, we are going to see a shift. I think they're going to be probably a bit more engaging with the rest of the world. You know, a lot of people, when we look at what's gone on in the last 4 years, really said, you know, we really do need to get more aggressive. We do need to push back on China and some of the things that they've been doing. I know I'd seen a number somewhere in the last couple of years, China had spent $100 billion more than they were allowed to in their entrance into the WTO. And I mean, they were really just abusing things on the domestic ag policy scene. That was purely just ag. And they were abusing things as far as trade policy around the world itself. But a lot of people over the course of the last 2 to 3 years in particular voiced the opinion, you know, maybe we should have gotten into the TPP and pushed forward on a united front instead of the U.S. going it alone. And that's really an argument about, do you like the way they handled it and why they handled it that way versus, you know, doing things another way. And you know, we could set down a whole round table and probably have 50 people with 50 different opinions about how it should be handled. But I think we're going to see a new administration try to be more engaging. As far as TPP is concerned, though, I guess, and I'd have to go back and look at that particular trade program and find out if we decide to go into the TPP, what are the regulations and what are the stipulations to us joining that pact? So, because it probably isn't nearly as advantageous as if we had gone back into it initially too. So, you know, I'm not so sure how that's going to play out. I think we'll have to give time for a lot of people to look at that particular program and look at, you know, the details of what happens if we join TPP and, you know, how that affects our trade as a whole. And I it's just too fresh for people to have a good idea on it. But I think there is going to be a difference in trade policy and, you know, a Biden administration probably generally being more engaging with the world versus the Trump administration. They were a little bit more willing to go it alone, to push hard. And I understand to a certain degree why they were that way. In that when you look at some of the big agreements around the world, you know, we always get pushed back a little bit when we go into an agreement with some kind of a joint effort. And it doesn't always necessarily end up to our advantage. And I think, you know, the Trump administration and people in the trade program there, especially Lighthizer, felt that, you know, we would be better off trying to push alone rather than trying to have to push other people out of the way to make them understand what we're really trying to do. So it's going to be a different environment, and I think it's going to be one we all have to learn from.
Okay. So, Clayton, your thoughts on it, and if you want to add any of your thoughts about USMCA, our agreement that we struck with Mexico and Canada, that many in agriculture were in favor of. What do you see as the new horizon when it comes to a new administration and potential trade relations?
Yeah, well, obviously there's a huge amount of uncertainty here. You know, who knows what Biden will do when he actually has the reins, assuming that happens. And with his cabinet and so forth. But I think as Dale kind of hinted at, I think the world definitely will see U.S. as a less prickly trade partner and maybe as a result, somewhat of a more reliable supplier going down the time horizon and the possible threats of, you know, tariffs and embargoes, even though it hasn't been an embargo, but a lot of tough talk along that direction. You know, I think that kind of talk will probably drop off the radar. So as such, you know, in the big picture, that might be a positive going forward. On the other side of that, I don't know. I think the trade agreements and so forth, they're all great. And they do a lot to smooth relations and maybe give some amount of certainty to expectations and so forth. But the bottom line is, if a country needs our product, I don't care what the agreement is or the lack of agreement, they're going to find a way to buy it. And if they don't like us for other reasons besides availability or non-availability of grain, even including the price of that grain, they won't buy it. So I think to that extent, a lot of these trade agreements are grossly overestimated in terms of their importance. Because even like this last whole thing that we're involved with right now with China, we've got an agreement and it was like, probably the most heralded agreement in the history of agriculture, and it hasn't happened. You know, so I don't know whether it's, you talk about the USMCA or the TPP or whatever. They're great. I'm not saying we shouldn't pursue them, but in the big picture of things, supply demand and competitive price and political skirmishes trump all. Yes.
Okay. Well, Clayton, let's get back to supply and demand and some of the factors there. Our WASDE report that we saw last Tuesday from USDA certainly put a spark in the markets. We had quite the rally in soybean futures. You know, we've cooled to some degree since then as we speak on this Monday. But do the numbers in that November WASDE report, does it place more importance on our December report rather than what we've given it attention in the past? What are you looking forward to there?
That's a great question, Rusty. I don't know that it puts more importance on the December report specifically or per se. For one thing, there's an awful lot of disappointment, I think, in USDA numbers, and maybe there's a little bit of an industry bias now towards trying to rely less on them. Because let's face it, in the last 3 or 4 months, the USDA's, and I'm not trying to place blame or anything, they're doing the best they can. I'm sure it's an extremely tough challenge that they face every day. But there's no question there's been some huge shocks and a lot of sectors of the market, a lot of things that people have taken for granted, really had the rug pulled out from under them. So I think, you know, maybe there's going to be a little bit of skepticism, justifiably so, you know, relying too much on anybody's numbers for that matter, but whether it's USDA's and God only knows China's numbers, you know, you need to take with a grain of salt. But that being said, I think, especially in soybeans, I mean, that carryover of 190 million bushels, you got a stocks to usage ratio now 4.2. That's extremely tight. As a matter of fact, I would like to pull up a couple charts if I could here. Let me just get, first of all, the corn. This is that on the screen?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. Okay, good. Okay, this show, the red number is the stocks to usage ratio in the U.S., and the green number is world coarse grain stocks to usage ratio. For the world, I like to use coarse grain instead of just corn. But you can see the corn number. Now, the U.S. axis is on the left. So, you know, we've got like 11.5 stocks to usage ratio in the U.S. on corn. It's the lowest in maybe 5 or 6 years, but it's still fairly comfortable, and we've been a heck of a lot tighter than this in corn, okay? So I think something's got to change in this corn market for corn to fundamentally have the fuel to really advance a lot further. I'm not saying it can't by any means. I mean, the safrinha crop in Brazil, when that finally gets planted, could be a problem. Who knows what China will end up buying? That seems to be the hot rumor right now that they've got their finger on the button to buy a lot more, but we don't know. On the other hand, if you look at the soybean one, this is a little more remarkable. I mean, look at that red number. That's taking a nosedive here. Now, the stocks to usage ratio there was 4.2, like I said, in the U.S. And the world is getting pretty snug, too. I mean, we've been a heck of a lot tighter. Look back in the mid-90s on that green line. But in my opinion, there's no comparison. If you look strictly at fundamentals, the bean stocks to usage is 4.2. Corn's is 11.5. Of course, wheat's is like, what, 45 or 50. And it's all relative, of course, but it seems to me that beans they're the ones that are going to carry the ball here one way or another. And you asked about, you know, reaction to future reports or data or whatever. I think beans are sort of the pile of gasoline-soaked rags in the corner. We could squeak by right now, you know, 190 million bushel carryover. You go back, can't remember the exact year, but the carryover got as low as 92 million. I mean, we were truly running on fumes then. And maybe by the time USDA raises exports a little bit, we'll be down at that level again this year. But the point is, this bean market it really can't take another bullish input without, in my opinion, really starting to have to ration demand. And that's something to keep an eye on. So I think looking forward, I think there's going to be a lot more scrutiny of any data and USDA reports or weather forecasts, particularly in Brazil at first, regarding beans than corn.
Okay. Dale, may I ask you a question about wheat, or would you like to expand on that idea?
I want to follow up on this before we go on to wheat here, and then, yeah, I'll take a question on wheat. The one thing we have to remember, soybeans are, of the three major grains that we raise in the world, really a little bit of a different animal. If we look at wheat or we look at coarse grains or corn, however you want to play it out, you still have a crop that's dominantly a northern hemisphere crop. And yes, we do have a large crop of corn that now comes out of Brazil, and we have a fair or a modest sized crop that comes out of Argentina, but still the bulk of your corn production by a large measure is in the northern hemisphere. Soybeans are a different animal, because soybeans, now we've gotten to a point to where almost half the crop is grown in the southern hemisphere, two countries in particular, Brazil and Argentina, and a little bit in Paraguay and Uruguay, et cetera. And, you know, the rest of it is up in the northern hemisphere. So the world is really shifting into a point where they have to get this comfort level with the fact that every 6 months I have a new crop. And that new crop coming on really dictates a lot about what the price structure is going to do in that 6 month period itself. So we're really working with a modest bean carry out, or a tight bean carry out, really, in all fairness, 190 million bushel here in the U.S. But, you know, even if we raise, let's say, 125 million ton crop in Brazil, they're still going to overwhelm the export market once we get into late February, but March, April, May, June, and July. There's just no way around it, you know, unless they have just an absolute blowout drought. And right now, when you look at the weather, we are, the rainy season started a little late down there. And we got to remember, they have a dry season and a rainy season. The rainy season generally starts sometime in October. It came about 3 weeks, maybe a little bit more late this year. But we are getting rain down there now. The people are talking about the La Nina. La Nina tends to have good moisture. Central Brazil and north, where it tends to be drier, in very southern Brazil, Rio Grande in particular, and down into Argentina. So as we start looking at this, it's weather over the next 2 months, and probably as we get later into December and even into January, that's really going to dictate both the size of the Brazilian crop and the Argentine crop. So we really have no idea how either of these crops are going to work out, if they're going to have real problems or if they're going to have a huge crop. But I'd say, knowing the tendency, we're going to have an okay crop. And because of the size of production down there relative to us here, you know, they're still going to overwhelm the world export trade. And you know, then you start having people, by the time we get out into March and certainly into April, how many acres are we going to plant to both crops here in the U.S.? Because that starts to dictate how things work along again. So, you know, Clayton is right. We really need something to really give us the fuel. Beans probably have a bit better chance than corn does, but we're going to have to wait and see how those South American crops come out.
Okay. I want to ask you about wheat, if I may, Dale. We've been focusing on dry weather in areas of Russia. We've had dry weather in the central and southern plains in some areas. And we talk about La Nina being dry in Argentina. Can there be a bullish case made for wheat futures on the world stage?
Mildly bullish, but not wildly bullish. Let's put it that way, you know, at least at this point, because we are beyond our northern hemisphere crop. And now we're worried about our spring crop next year and what kind of crops we're going to have. The one question that I always give people in regard to wheat, well, there's two. Number one, wheat's a weed.
Yeah.
Laugh about that. But more important than that, you don't make a wheat crop by the conditions necessarily into fall or even through winter. It really is a crop that responds negatively or positively to whatever weather you have in the spring. I think this year, when you look at the U.S., the big question people are going to have going forward depends upon what kind of condition the U.S. crop is in when we get towards the end of winter. And will people rip up some winter wheat acres and plant it over into soybeans or into corn? That's going to be an unknown we have to deal with. When we go into a place like Russia, and it is really dry in key areas around the Black Sea over there, you know, what kind of problems will they have or not have this winter? Will they have severe winter kill itself going on top of a crop? But what will happen in a lot of places in Russia is that if they have a lot of winter kill, or if they have a really poor crop when we start to break dormancy, they rip it and they'll plant it to a spring crop itself. Now, the spring crop's a lower yielding. It'll impinge on the size of production that they have next year, but it doesn't necessarily, especially given the kind of supplies of wheat we have around the world, it doesn't necessarily say that wheat is going to get extraordinarily tight. And I would take people back through things that happened in the 1970s, 1980s, and even the 90s. You know, we had the Great Russian Grain Robbery in the early 70s, and we had wheat at that time blow up, and we had $6 wheat, and then we settled down to where we traded $2.50 to $4, what seemed like forever. We could never really get a sustained bull market going back then. Why? Because wheat is raised so many places in the world. Yeah. And when you have that happen, it's hard to have enough of a problem everywhere to really tighten up supplies a lot. You know, we had a brief spike in 1995, 96, and basically that was because of some extreme problems we had there. And then, you know, we had the big run when things got extraordinarily tight there back in 2008, 2007, 2009, where we really got down to the bottom of the bin in wheat in the world. But since we've padded it. And China, like everyone knows out there, they have a big supply of wheat. And I think that's something that probably will play into China's corn purchasing program as we go through the next few months, too.
Okay. Again, this is a virtual conference this year for obvious reasons. For my final question, I'd like to pose to both of you gentlemen. When it comes to livestock prices, when it comes to the potential for further lockdowns, further restrictions, as we move forward into the winter flu season, with everything on the horizon, daunting challenges, what's your outlook for livestock prices in general when it comes to the futures trade? And also, we have a new tool, a new pork cutout futures and index that we've got at our disposal, too. Your thoughts on that, Clayton?
Yeah, that new contract sounds interesting. I'll let somebody else go first.
It's new.
Yeah, that's kind of reminiscent of the old pork belly days, if you ask me. And as a former floor manager of the Mercantile Exchange, I don't know how excited I am about having anything close to a pork belly contract. Be that as it may, the COVID thing, you know, it's kind of played havoc with people's emotions and everything, but I've had a hard time drawing any kind of correlation between, you know, the ebbs and flows of the fear factor and all the data on COVID and livestock prices or usage or anything else. So I think I would kind of tend to say it's sort of business as usual going forward would be my guess.
Okay. What are your thoughts, Dale?
You know, I think Clayton's probably right. It's kind of business as usual going forward. There's little tweaks that we play off in here right now. Number one, it's amazing. Retailers own a lot of meat. Yeah. Seriously do. They own a lot of meat. And I think they probably bought a lot getting ready to go into the winter flu season, you know, and the unknowns about COVID to kind of, you know, keep from running out in their meat counters as we go through time in here, beef being somewhat storable, but even pork and chicken, you can hold it in freezer if you need to kind of move it out in there. But, you know, that inventory of meat that they own right now kind of makes me think, you know, they're going to get ready to have to start to move some of this sometime too. So there might be some good retail buys out in there. The two things that have come along that really kind of help make me believe that it'll be more business as usual, other than we could have short term, are, what is it? One of them's Pfizer and the other one is Motiva.
Moderna,
that have announced vaccines. And you know, we still got some hurdles to go through with those, but those from a psychological aspect, they're going to come back and they're going to have an impact not only on the consumer, but people that in the middle, the pipeline in the meat industry itself of, you know, we really don't have the problems or potentially don't have the problems that we faced last spring. And really it was the pipeline issue that really hurt us more than anything last spring by shutting down slaughter capacity in such a big way, backing up livestock on the farm and also emptying the meat counters out and, you know, making people fearful about what was ahead. One interesting twist that I ran across about a month ago now, you cannot buy a freezer if you go into an appliance store. They literally sold out this last year. So how much meat do consumers already have in freezers right now? And, you know, once you fill up an inventory, you know, yeah, you've used it down somewhat, but you still have somewhat of a buffer there to work with. So I don't think the consumer is going to be quite as panicky as he was back then. So I don't think our meat counters are going to work out. I think so. Things are back to business as usual. And if that's the case, you know, we're working through seasonally the heavy supply of hogs. We've got hog weights that are a little heavy right now. I know the percent lean on carcasses has really hit a pretty hard hit here recently. And I think that's because the weights have gone up. So we got a lot of hogs to work through. And so I think as we go through the early part of winter here, we're going to find a lot of pork flowing through the system. Like I said, you know, retailers own a lot of meat, beef in particular, and I think we're going to see that flowing into the system out in there. So we may see a cattle market, a beef market that is a little bit soft over time in here. But I think once we get through the holidays, cattle, I think, will tend to hold up well because that's traditional. The end of year holidays are a traditional red meat, and especially beef holiday itself. We aren't going to have the big office parties, but I think we're probably still going to see people consuming a lot of beef, and especially if beef's good. So cattle market can kind of move sideways here and not have a lot of move to the upside, but not have a lot of drag. But I think if we're in January and we're seeing promise that, yes, we are going to have a vaccine come along, I think cattle get a lift out in there as they do seasonally as we go through winter and into spring and see them go back up into 120. Well, we could get 125, maybe something like that. I think feeder cattle, you know, that are around 135 or they're around 130, I think we could probably move upwards into the 140s, maybe even up around 150 as we go out into the spring. And, you know, by then we'll see hogs start to get their seasonal push. And I think, you know, hog market next summer, unless we expand a whole lot, and I don't think that we're going to see a huge expansion given what's happened in the grain market. Yeah, we're probably going to look at some mid-70s to maybe even $80 hogs next summer.